But I have a worry that being not positive turns people off from wanting to talk about inequality. And also, several years on, if you want people to worry about inequality, one way to do it is not to talk directly about inequality, but to talk about the things that they are worried about. And if you look at the things that people worry about, they might worry about things like school, but often not if they don't have children in school. Well, they might worry about unemployment. Again, most people are not threatened by unemployment, at least not immediately. They might worry about mental illness, and again, the majority of us don't have, hopefully, a problem with mental illness, at least not at any one time. But everybody has an issue with housing, and most people have a problem with housing. But they rarely link that to inequality. What they most commonly link it to is, we don't have enough houses, they're not building enough. If they only built some more houses, we'd all be okay. And what I want to try to get over to you is an idea that that might not be the answer or the source of the problem with housing. This picture was produced in a lecture way back in 2001 by Robert Frank. And I think it was Richard and Kate showed it me first. Let me put it back again. And it's the American Dream Home. The home, if you're a fairly well-paid American, that you should really aspire to have. One of those wings is actually a garage. Right? Those are the garage with windows like that. And the floor plan has several studies and so on. And what Robert Frank was saying way back in 2001 when he produced his book about the problems of the middle class in America was that this kind of aspiration to always wanting more is going to lead to big, big, big problems. And the key thing about this for me is that Robert Frank wasn't an obscure economist in the States. Robert Frank was writing textbooks with a bloke called Ben Bernanke. Ben Bernanke, who I think has just stepped down from being chair of the Federal Reserve, also knew that things were going to go very badly wrong in the United States. They just didn't know what to do about it. By badly wrong, and I realise unless you've got bionic eyesight, if you're not sitting on the front row, you can't see these things. This is showing how long, in various states in the United States, up until 2012, the average family was sitting in their house after they stopped paying the mortgage on it, waiting to be evicted. And in New York State, this got up to 3 years, on average, of people sitting in homes they were no longer paying for because they couldn't afford to pay the mortgage payments. There are a lot of things about housing that have happened outside of Britain that we just don't know about. We're not that well informed about how bad the crash in the States was. Many people in Britain don't know that the Irish market has crashed down to half prices and is still going down slowly, despite all the little stories you get in Irish newspapers about recovery. Whenever you get data, it's still going down. Spain's at half peak prices, and Madrid's now going down. Greece is going down. Iceland went down. In fact, almost in every direction around the periphery of Europe, apart from here, there's been an almighty housing crash. And here, we have this. This is the map of this country. Yep, you can get it. It's produced by the garden. This is what the country looks like if you make areas the size of how much the properties were. Okay? And that's London sitting at heading towards 1.4 trillion. These numbers are a few months out of date, so it'll be an extra 100 billion by now. I've forgotten, you're clicking up a billion every few seconds at the moment, but it's fine, isn't it? It's safe. There's nothing going to go wrong in London. This is bizarre. This is historically extreme. It causes all kinds of problems, and it isn't caused by a housing shortage. We haven't suddenly demolished thousands and thousands of properties in London. I'm not saying you couldn't do some more property in London. I would build up. The main reason I would build still in Britain is for the extra people who are going to need houses, which are going to be people still coming into this country. But this is not about a sudden shortage of housing. I feel a bit mean having this quote. He could tell he was a PR man, and he could instantly tell when he was asked how many houses he owned in 2009 not to answer the question. The reason I feel mean is that we now know that Tony Blair has bought seven local properties, including most recently a mansion, or went over, is it £1.5 million? For his son. And it's got many bedrooms. And that, to put it bluntly, this is why there's a housing shortage in London, because it's not just Tony buying seven houses for people who only need one bedroom at most, who have got multiple bedrooms. There's a lot of people with lots of money who've been buying property that they do not use in London. My favourite... Yeah, I'll do the bedroom tax. My favourite statistic about London, that the 2011 census was the first census to count bedrooms. So it actually tells us how many bedrooms there are everywhere. And there are least bedrooms in the whole of Britain, in inner London, per person, as you might expect. Inner London has the fewest bedrooms. But it still has more bedrooms than there are people in inner London. So if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else on any night in inner London,
you could still
house. And it just tells you how many empty bedrooms there are. And of course, the empty bedrooms are in privately owned property. The highest number of empty bedrooms are in property that's owned outright. The next highest are in property where there's a mortgage. The next highest in private renting, and the fewest empty bedrooms are in social housing. So where do we go for the bedroom tax that people have leased? This is a big jump. It's to New York, and it's the skyscrapers. And it's just to show you how many were being built a year. Back then, it was just 70 metres to be a skyscraper. And the peak was 1934, because, of course, they're commissioned before the crash. And then you get this. No building for ages and ages. 1970, small crash, build again, small crash, and so on. What I want you to imagine is it's not impossible that we are here. It's not impossible that we're there. It's not that people stopped coming to New York or the population went down. This behaviour was seen after this point as extreme and irrational behaviour. I'm going to show you the same graph now, but worldwide. Now we're looking at buildings over 250 metres. Missing two buildings that are no longer here. And, okay, there's no reason why it should go down, but the majority of these very, very tall buildings worldwide have been built in the last 4 or 5 years. We may be switching to this, or it may be that what's about to happen is New York. My point isn't to try to predict the future, although it's ever so tempting to have a go doing it. But it's like predicting the stock market and so on, you can't. My point is the precarity of the situation we're in. There is absolutely nothing safe or stable about this situation we're in, particularly in London, or this picture worldwide. You're not looking at a steady building of skyscrapers. You're not looking at steady house prices. You're looking at a situation where you just don't know what's going to occur. This black line is mortgages being taken out of the United States. It plummeted, and now more people are repaying for the first time ever than are borrowing in the States. And the last little dip, the latest data I could get, that's continuing. There still has a giant banking crisis because more people want to pay back to the banks and borrow. Banks can't make money if people don't borrow from them. The dotted line is credit card payments going up to kind of compensate. But in no way is the financial crisis of 2008 over. Certainly not here and not in the US. But lots of people want to talk about it being over. Outside of London, the South East, we have areas where house prices have fallen a lot and are still falling a lot. These are the renovated Park Hill flats in Sheffield. They've managed to do up one block. All the other blocks are not being touched while they wait to try and sell the flats in this one block. This block is 5 minutes and 30 seconds away from the mainline train station, which is 2 hours and 15 minutes from King's Cross, Paddington, St Pancras. And I can't sell them. Oxford's the other way of London.
Sorry, Dan.
That's all right. I've only done this for ethnographic research. You can't do work on housing.
You're my
home repossessions. This is the space again, just to show you the level that they've got to of foreclosures and repossessions. It's quite hard to get up-to-date data for the States, but still a huge problem. House prices. Changes since 1983, and the point is it's unpredictable. I had this little line going down here. At the moment, we've just spiked again in the last few months. But there you just, you don't know which way it's going to go. You still don't know which way this thing is going to go. We do know, from more and more papers coming out, mainly again from the States, that this has lots of bad effects on people. And in a way, I'm quite interested in what are the mechanisms that get you from high inequality to poor health. I think there are lots of them. I'll give you my favourite example is that in unequal countries, doctors don't want to live in poor areas. So you end up with your doctors all in rich areas, and if doctors are only used for health, then that's a problem. Whereas in countries that are rich and more equal, the doctors are evenly spread and so on. But another mechanism is damage the housing market does. In areas of the States where they have some of the highest rates of repossessions, they've had some of the highest numbers of hospital admissions recently. So people are very stressed by the neighbourhood going under. In Britain, we have had, in the last 2 years, the first big absolute rise in mortality amongst the elderly that we've had, I think, since the 1930s. 2 weeks ago, it was announced that life expectancy has fallen for the first time for people aged over 65 in England and Wales. Hardly any comment on this at all. Public Health England tried to claim over the summer that it was the flu. Special kind of flu, it's been going on for a year and a half now, that they haven't taken any actual tests or swabs or done anything to say it's the flu. Two epidemiologists, one from Oxford, one from London, have said that the flu at most accounts for 5% of the extra deaths that are occurring amongst the elderly in Britain. So what is it? What is causing life expectancy to fall? What is causing more people to die? And that's complicated. That's when you begin to try to guess. But if you think over the last few years of things that have occurred, one thing that did occur, so about 2 years ago, was Southern Cross, the biggest provider of care homes in the country, went bust, and thousands and thousands of elderly people thought that they might be evicted, have to move from their homes. And these are people who are pretty frail to begin with. What we do know about this rise in mortality is that most of it's among women, not amongst men. And there's a big difference between elderly women and elderly men. Elderly men tend to be in a couple. Elderly women tend to be on their own. If you're an elderly man and austerity hits and things are bad, you're in a better situation on average because you've got somebody else with you. It's not just the Meals on Wheels being cut or the Southern Cross going. A general sense that life's getting worse may well be having an effect on this particular generation. And direct things. So one of the first things the incoming government did to save money was they actually cancelled the flu jabs. So a little bit of it could be flu. Okay, why have you got a housing crisis? House prices go up in lots of parts of London and the South East because the wages of these people are going up. The ability of other people to afford housing goes down because their income goes down. Between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 of all children in this country are now living in private renting. That's a massive increase in 10 or 15 years from almost nothing for children. Private renting 10 or 15 years ago was for students and a few executives and the last of the relic of the old private rented sector that had housed the vast majority of us 100 years ago. So now between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 kids in London, their families are moving on average every year because the landlords are evicting them to get better tenants in. So, in London, you are moving school often up to every year and you're losing all your friends every year, again and again and again. And I think people are interested in talking about that, and that's a way of going about inequality that's more direct. We've also got the extreme of who's coming in and what's coming in at the very top of the market. We've become a country which acts as a tax haven for the world super rich, who think that they can put their money into London and it's safe and it'll be taxed at the lowest rate in the world, which is essentially a few grand council tax and you can put your money and park it safely here. And it's building up a bubble. the cuts, if you've looked at all the stuff about the effects of the cuts and who's most affected, this comes from Oxfam. It says the poorest 10th for seeing a 20% drop in ability to spend, the richest 10th for 1.5. And that's directly connected to this booming housing market in parts of London and this collapsing housing market outside the southeast of England. This slide comes from Becky Tunstall. It's probably the most important one. Becky Tunstall is Professor of Housing and Director for the Centre of Housing Policy at York. And Becky's compared censuses over time to look at how many rooms we've got, how much housing we have. Because we've never actually had more housing than we have now. We've never had more rooms per person than we have now. Partly because we have been building, doing some building until the crash, but most of our building hasn't been new houses. It's been extra rooms, it's been extensions, it's been building into the rooms, it's been adding space. So we've actually made our stock bigger and bigger and bigger over time. But we haven't been doing it equally. If you go back to 1911, between 1911 and 1921, we had an increase in housing inequality. This is the ratio of how many rooms the best off tenth of the population get to the worst off tenth. Around about 1911, the best off tenth each had on average four times as many rooms to live in as the poorest tenth. Now back then, that might have meant they got one room per person, and the poorest tenth were living four to a room. Okay, but that was the inequality ratio then. And just like income inequality and other inequalities, it rose to 1921. By census year, 1921 is our most unequal year in this country. And then after that, things got shared out a bit better. Not much, but at least better. Things were getting improving. Council houses were built with more space. The very rich had to sell their London townhouses and divide them into flats. In the 70s, and housing was given out more equally. And that occurred all the way through to 1991, because wealth and housing lags income inequality. And then you see a sudden increase in most of these extra rooms went to the best off 10th. Then this massive increase of 2011, the biggest increase ever. So that now the best off 10th of people in Britain each on average have five times as many rooms per person as the poorest 10th. There are lots and lots of rooms, but increasingly they're being hoarded by people who are fairly wealthy, tend to be older, rattling around in large houses, not necessarily miles away from anywhere. In London, the population has gone up in every borough apart from Kensington and Chelsea. Kensington and Chelsea have seen a fall in population in the last 10 years. There's more space in Kensington and Chelsea than there was 10 years ago to house people. I've got three slides about what I do, and then I'd love to hear what you would suggest doing. I'm not completely against building. Personally, having moved to Oxford and failed to get a house, I would build in the Oxford Greenbelt, but I'd hardly build anywhere else on Greenfield sites. I build in the Oxford Greenbelt because its town's far too small. We need a decent-sized town between Birmingham and London. We should all go by bike, but anyway, that's the last thing I promise to say about Oxford. And I build up in London, because London is Europe's only megacity, and it needs to build vertically. But in general, we do not need, our problem isn't building. If we build more, the way we're going, people at the top will get more second homes, more holiday homes, and landlords will buy more of these homes to rent out to people for the maximum profit they can take. What we need to do is to do something about our land and housing tax. You can introduce mansion taxes, but they're very crude. Or you can do something slightly subtler and simply extend the council tax regime. Stop it wherever it stops at the moment. Wales, I think, goes up to I, goes up to H. Whoever brought in the council tax was a genius because they left us all the letters that go to Z. Right? And I've worked it out, even if you double the bands every time, we've only got to go to N. And that gets the Sultan of Brunei in at N. The Sultan of Brunei, who owns on Kensington Palace Gardens, currently applies for a council tax rebate.
We love it.
Yeah. And he does it because he's making a point, because he thinks he's overtaxed. He thinks he's a benefactor. Take the council tax bandings, take it out at the moment to N or higher, so that nobody needs to complain that they can't possibly afford this, because somebody richer than them will have to pay even more. And that makes the 1% feel happy. There's more inequality in the 1% than there is in the other 99%. So don't treat them as one group. Tax the top of the 1% far, far more than the bottom of the 1%. And you might even get some support from the bottom of the 1%. You never know. But that's one thing I do. We need to rebound council tax. It's very easy. You use Zoopla. If you want to know what a property is worth, type it into Zoopla. But anyway, that could be done fairly quickly. The effect of doing that would be to dampen the market. The fear would be how much of a dampening it would have. It's often been said to be impossible, but Ireland is currently going through the process of creating an entire registry of all its property to introduce an emergency land tax. It claims it will cost 3% of what they will make to do it. We've been getting there halfway for decades. We still haven't completed the land register. It's rather obvious why we haven't, because there are certain vested interests who do not want it recorded who owns the land. Secondly, we have a policy, a series of policies that are different in each of the four countries of the UK, which give people a right to stay in their house when they can't pay the mortgage anymore and become a tenant. They already exist, they're little known about. If there is a further housing crash and other things go wrong, we need those policies to be strengthened. And that means families can stay in their houses when they can't pay the mortgage, they become tenants. It also means that all the people who are buying houses that cost a bit more because they're not near council estates, which is the primary determinant of a local house price, is how far are you away from poor areas. There's no point in buying a house because it's not near a council estate anymore if your next door neighbours can become council tenants. This happened in the past, and I just say you need it again. Second homes, holiday homes, then property needs to be included in fairer property taxation. Camden's trying to do it. Eric Pickles is trying to stop Camden making people pay 200% council tax on empty property. 7,000, I think, second homes in Camden. There's no need for the bedroom tax. As I said about the number of bedrooms and rooms in Britain, we do actually have enough space and rooms in this country for everybody to have a spare bedroom. It's not extravagant. Building. I've yet to see any politician get up and say the real reason we need building is because if we are economically lucky, we will carry on having relatively high immigration if people are coming. But you're going to have to build houses for immigration. That, nobody will say that. It's fairly obvious. But other than that, that is the reason we need to build. We need benefits to rise faster than wages. We need wages to rise faster than salaries. Grant Shapps, now the chairman of the Conservative Party, 2 years ago when he was Minister for Housing, said we need wages to go up by 2% more than houses, house prices. No, even Grant Shapps can see that there was a problem. We can't carry on with these things out of balance.
Could you go back to why that was one to explain to people?
About why we can't have this?
Why benefits, yes.
Oh, okay.
The comparatives.
At the moment, for the last two or three decades, benefits have been going up far, far lower than wages. So that benefits used to be something you could actually live on, that you could imagine living on for a short amount of time. Now benefits are something that at least the middle class don't even know the amount of and just don't imagine living on. You need to get to a level where people are not entirely reliant on housing benefit. The other thing I haven't said here, housing benefit was brought in by Margaret Thatcher, the current version of it. And the huge expansion of housing benefit occurred in the 1980s as a direct payment of money to landlords. Instead of paying landlords directly, you should improve benefits in general. They're going to try to give for universal credit the rent money partly. If somebody wants to talk about it later, but it's a terrible mess. It's going the wrong way. Okay. No. Okay.
Yeah,
rent controls. Shelter estimate, although they won't publish the figure, they estimate only 2% of people in this country are landlords. Now clearly rent controls would be unpopular with the 2% who are landlords. I suspect I can guess the way those 2% vote. But I don't think the block vote of landlords is terribly important to any political party. 98% of people are not landlords. If you were to control rents at all, we wouldn't be in a situation where landlords are outbidding anybody else trying to buy property. We're heading rapidly back to the 19th century. We need to stop it. You might almost not need rent controls in that one of the major mortgage firms, I think it's Britannica, has just broken its tracking rate for buy-to-let landlords, and they suddenly had their interest put up 2%. But landlords can claim interest off tax. That all needs to stop. Squatting's being criminalised. It really shouldn't be criminal, it should be a civil offence. But a whole set of things that some landlords, particularly in London, are doing, housing entire families in one room, all the sheds that are being used, thousands of sheds in Slough are being used for housing. You need to make that criminal offence rather than a civil offence, because you need to scare this tiny proportion of people that are willing to do almost anything for money. Even that might not stop them. And lastly, we've got to recognise that housing is one of the biggest contributors we have to pollution in the environment. You do not want to be knocking down large amounts of housing in the north of England and building large amounts of housing in the south of England. It's partly a waste of money, but it's very, very bad for the environment. The advert for the book, which still has to be finished, but trying to tap in, that says £500 for the average price of a brick. I've been trying to work out recently how thick the layer of gold paint would have to be that you painted property in Kensington with for the property to actually be worth the value it's going for. It's not a thin layer of gold paint anymore. It actually has some thickness to it. There are obviously problems for young people with housing, but for older people, people are beginning to use housing for their pension. They're beginning to think this will be the only way I'm going to avoid poverty in old age. And so it's creating upset and precarity right across society. It'll also be damaging social relations in families. Because you can no longer, as a young middle class person, work hard and get a good job and live in this city. You have to have a relative who's got some money, and you have to get on with that relative who's got some money. And that creates false social relations. You might think I'd love to have those problems. But I think it's well worth looking at how inequality causes problems way up the social scale, not just for people who are average or for people who are poor. The last thing I'll say, and I'd love this if somebody could verify this or tell me I'm making a mistake before I shout this stuff out too much. The Institute of Fiscal Studies produced a report in June this year in which, after about 100 pages, they revealed a particular statistic, which was that in the 1980s, inequalities increased for everybody. Got wider and wider, the middle came away from the bottom, the next ones did better, and the very top did really well in the 1980s. But since 1991, according to the IFS, we've actually been becoming more equal, or at least all of us, just ever so slightly, apart from the 1%. Since 1991, the 1% have taken off, but the other 99% have had ever so slight coming together. Now, this is now most acutely felt between the 2% and the 1%. The 2%, these are powerful people, 2% is essentially between 100,000 and 160,000 a year. General practitioner, headmaster, London worthy, all the head of a school in Oxford recently I met who cannot afford success to live in the city he's teaching in. I thought if he lived where his pupils lived, he would be able to. But I think it's worth using the intense distress felt by people in the top 10th of society who are not in the top one, because they cannot do what their parents did anymore and they are feeling a squeeze. And if you have a large proportion of the top 10% of society on your side, you have an enormous amount of power and they talk endlessly about housing. That's why I wanted to talk about housing. Thank you very much.